This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Later on this edition of Ozarks, a conversation with a professor at UA Fort Smith about his new play that will debut Friday. And a preview of the Grammy-winning Tierney Sutton Band's performance this weekend at Walton Arts Center.
First, the next several days are significant for local film and local filmmakers. Later today, we expect an important announcement to be made about a local documentary film project in Fayetteville. We'll have details about that tomorrow. And tomorrow, the first ever offshoot film festival opens at East Square Plaza on the Fayetteville Square and continues at three different downtown Fayetteville venues through Sunday. You can learn more about that weekend of more than 50 films at seedlingfilm.com. And then Monday, at the Fayetteville Public Library, the world premiere of a documentary based in Fayetteville.
My hope is one day I'll be able to go back to the old country and see my people, the Palestinians and the Israelis, reconcile and live in peace.
It's very hard to hate somebody when you're looking them in the eye.
The groundbreaking ceremony was held for the area's first synagogue in Fayetteville today.
The things that people in the Middle East...
Temple of Peace is the filmed record of the inspiration for and construction of Temple Shalom. The film, created by Hyatt Tushev, follows the story of Fadil Bayari building the first synagogue in Fayetteville.
As a Muslim community member here, I didn't know about this whole, awesome story before I spoke to one of my professors, and I was looking for something that has to do with Muslims, because I come from a Muslim country, and she suggested to do a documentary about this Palestinian Muslim who's building a synagogue. I didn't know about it. It was like a well-kept secret here in Ozark, so once I found out, I thought this is a great story to tell. So I decided to make a documentary about it.
Last week, Hyatt Tushev came to KUAF to discuss his film, Temple of Peace, which will have its world premiere Monday night at 7 at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Once I started my research, before I even started shooting the film, I realized that Muslims and Jews, they used to live in a complete harmony back in Spain, and where they used to build like buildings to each other, and where they lived in the same communities. So I thought, after the research, I thought this whole conflict started like 60 years ago. So it was a modern conflict going on. So I thought people need to know that, it's possible for, people of different religion to actually live in peace. So once I, did my research, I actually spoke to the local community members, the Jews and Muslims and Christians that are, they find living next to each other. And they want to make a difference and be like an example to the rest of the world, this little community here in Ozarks. Yeah.
Did you get a feeling that people you talked to that were connected to this the construction of Temple Shalom thought they were, that what they are doing could be making a bigger difference other than just in Fayetteville, the Ozarks, or Northwest Arkansas?
Yeah. To me, this whole... sometimes when I was talking to them, it looked like, they're being a little idealistic when it comes to talking about the people of different faiths living together, especially Jews and Muslims. They talk that they want to be an example to the rest of the world. But there were also other people here who were, putting me back to reality by talking, but that I should also include the actual situation in Palestine and Israel, the modern conflict. So yes, people here, they really trying to be a model, but how much impact they're making across the world, you know, we will judge it after watching the movie. I mean, I think that, you know, this community is trying its best to be a model to the rest of the world. How much impact they're making, I don't know.
How long did it take you to make the documentary?
It took me, it was a part of my thesis documentary film. It's a part of my master's degree. So I started working almost 2.5 years ago, back into 2007. So I thought I'm going to be done with it like in 6 months, and I'm going to be editing and I'll write my script and all that. But it took me more than that because the actual construction took 2 years. So, which in a way was nice because I could actually follow from the very beginning when they laid the first brick there to the very end, to the dedication of the Temple Shalom. So the documentary was a chronological story of the whole building being erected from the scratch. And I followed the whole process, and I really enjoyed, the communication and building my story as far as the documentary goes.
Learn more about construction than you knew beforehand?
I think the construction managers themselves, they learn, a lot about construction's construction, process themselves, because in the process of building the synagogue, they had some difficulties themselves as far as the finance goes and logistics and all that. And in the meantime, they had this whole crisis, the economy crisis and all that. Also, there was ice storm too, so that damaged some of it too, the building process. So it was a long, elaborate experience for them and me.
When did you know you were done with the documentary?
with documentaries, you got to stop at some point because you can keep working on it and keep working, trying to make it better. But I decided that I will stop as soon as the building is done. So once the building was done, I sat down, I wrote my script. And my professors at the university, advisors, they helped me to, refinish the script and polish it and edit the documentary. So right now I'm done with it. I don't want to go back to it. So this is it. This is the last version.
Who's seen it so far?
My thesis, documentary film thesis advisors, three of them, have seen, and also, yeah, and the trailer is online for everybody to watch. So, yeah, not many people, but the world premiere is going to be on October 11th at the Fayetteville Public Library at 7 p.m. So that's going to be the world premiere. And for some reason, I didn't even know about it. Some people, I think it in L.A., it's a activists for the peace, they posted on the Huffington Post the whole announcement about it. I didn't know.
Does that make you feel uncomfortable at all, or does it make you feel kind of happy that your work is getting attention from somewhere else?
Yeah, as a new filmmaker, it makes me very uncomfortable when I found out that it's been circulated out there and people are interested. I mean, I got some emails from different kinds of people saying that they're really looking forward to it. You never know. Being in this kind of business, it could pick up and maybe they will start a nationwide premiere all over the place. Maybe it will pick up. Maybe people in Israel or maybe people in Palestine will watch it. With all the given technology of internet, maybe we can post it online. It's for a non-profit cause. All I wanted to make is, get the message across, because I think this story is really wonderful and really remarkable story to tell. So I had feeling that I'm obliged, that I have to tell this story to everybody, to deliver the message of these people in this community trying to live a peaceful life.
Haya Tuchev is the creator of the documentary film Temple of Peace. The premiere screening is scheduled for Monday night, beginning at 7, at the Fayetteville Public Library.
Is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. In theater, actors often perform in shows that were created by playwrights years ago. On October 7th, a brand new play will debut at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith. Season of Entertainment 30 begins with Imogen, a play written and directed by theater director Bob Stevenson that addresses the struggles that come with growing up.
Imogen is about a young girl who lives in today's society, who is sort of oppressed by media and male-dominated society, and has expectations that are placed on her that she doesn't necessarily want to be a part of, you know. But she's used to it, and she understands it, and so she does it. And it takes a little life-changing experience in order for her to see that this isn't the life she wants to lead, and that she wants to her adult life is going to go a different direction.
This original piece is part of a trilogy that includes Stevenson's previous works, Coracunda and Aurora. The preceding installments in the series were created collaboratively with students. Stevenson says, for better or worse, he created Imogen on his own.
I come about plays from a very actor-centric point of view. I mean, I wasn't brought up as a playwright, I was brought up as a performer. And then, you know, then I came to be a director, and only recently, if I am at all to be considered a playwright, I would consider that a very recent addition to my stable. But I'd created a lot of plays before, but usually they had been created either collaboratively with other actors through improvisation and then finally locking down on a script based on the work we had created in rehearsal, or generating a structure, much like Commedia dell'arte or Kabuki or something, where you generate a structure and then you're allowed to sort of play within that structure. And this is the first time I've sort of gone at it from a traditional playwright point of view, where I had all the text on the page, and then we did readings and we reworked the script. And before we got to the first day of rehearsal, you know, we had a draft of the script that we really liked, which is apparently the correct way to do it, but it's very unusual for me. I'm usually coming in to the first day without all that and saying, this is where we want to go. Let's see if we can get from here to there on our own ability and rehearsal. It's been a new experience.
One of the things that separates Imogen from his previous two plays is the amount of dialogue it contains.
The other two shows, Coracunda had no text at all in it. It was all done through movement, so it was more of a theater dance sort of piece. And Aurora was about half text and half visuals, like a movie almost, where there's less dialogue. And I wanted to make the third one, be mostly theatrical, mostly text, and so this one has the largest text component of all three. And for me, that was sort of another reason to do it. I felt like we hadn't quite explored the journey completely. We had done silent, we had done sort of half and half, and now I needed to do mostly text.
The times, places, and characters differ in each play, so the three stories are tied together through a shared theme.
They're not related necessarily from a narrative point of view. They're more related thematically. They all three deal with coming of age, sort of rite of passage. They're all basically the same story, just told from three different points of view, three different times and place, almost as if, well, it's sort of a universal quality, that idea of now I'm a kid and I'm about to become an adult, you know, and what is the journey from me being a child and then turning into an adult, and what do I have to go through to get from point A to point B? And they all three basically tell that sort of thematic story. You just have different characters, different situations. And so that's how they're linked, you know, is through sort of the theme.
The cast is comprised of 40 students, some theater majors, some not. Stevenson says one of the challenges of working with such a large cast is finding enough room for everyone on the stage.
It's a relatively confined space. Our main playing area is only 24 feet across there. Then we have the two side areas. And so, yeah, shoving 40 people into that little circle is, it feels very claustrophobic, which is very useful at times because Imogen, the main character, we want her to feel claustrophobic a lot, like all these pressures are sort of weighing down on her. But at the same time, getting people to move in a coordinated fashion in that small of a space is difficult.
Stevenson is being assisted by 12 choreographers and coaches, 5 crew members, 2 stage managers, and an assistant director. In addition to acting, many of the cast members are also lending a hand to the crew.
We have several pieces of scenery and things that articulate up and down, like the trapeze, and there is a point that actors ride up and down on so they can go up into the air and come back down, and the other actors man that. They pull the line that run those things. There are lots of special effects that the actors are doing. There's water effects and bubble effects and snow effects and UV light and all kinds of stuff, and the actors themselves are actually... And in some of the scenes, the actors actually provide all of the light with lights that they're holding, and so... So they're kind of cast and crew at the same time, but it is a very large company.
All of these special effects are helpful in bringing Imogen's imagination to life for the audience.
Imogen tends to go into these daydreams where it's sort of half reality. I like to refer to it as magic realism. And she begins to work through things in her mind in a more expressionistic fashion. And the trapeze provides one of those moments in the show where it's not, you know, you don't see people running down the street jumping on a trapeze every day. But in her mind, this is a good substitute for what she's trying to work through.
Stevenson says the production is suggested for those 16 and older because of mild profanity and violence and strong themes of sensuality. The curtain goes up at 7:30 p.m. October 7th through the 9th at Breedlove Auditorium. There is also a 2:30 matinee on October 9th. Admission is $6 for the public and free to students. More information is available at 479-788-7300. Or uafortsmith.edu. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Startling images of oil-drenched pelicans have faded from public view since the 3-month-long Gulf oil spill disaster last spring and early summer has abated. The National Audubon Society has a historical presence along the Gulf Coast and was a first responder. Jacqueline Froelich visits with Kevin Pearson, Vice President of National Audubon's Lower Mississippi Flyaway, and provides a status report.
For 3 months, British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon oil rig spill in the Gulf of Mexico leaked an estimated 5 million barrels. That's 200 million gallons of crude oil before it was capped in late July, then permanently plugged September 19th. The oil slick at its worst covered 4,000 square miles. Pools of it were pulled by the Gulf Loop current southeast along the Florida coast and up into the Atlantic. Untapped petroleum reserves naturally seep into the ocean, which has remarkably evolved a capacity via bacteria to consume the thick sludge. But this was catastrophic, a leak of historic proportions. According to NOAA, about half of the oil leaked into the Gulf remains on or below the surface. Others say as much as 75% of it is still unaccounted for. Among the first responders was the National Audubon Society. Kevin Pearson is Vice President of National Audubon's Lower Mississippi Flyaway Program. He manages the states of Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana.
Well, the Gulf Coast, and in particular those marshes in Louisiana, are incredible places for biodiversity. It's also, when you think about this time of year and all the birds that are migrating, you know, over 60% of birds in the U.S. utilize that corridor through all along the Mississippi River, and then so Louisiana and those marshes are kind of the front door after that long journey across the Gulf of Mexico, and so it's a very important place for birds and wildlife.
Beaches and preserved ecosystems along a 3-state stretch absorbed the brunt of this spill.
Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. There's a number of national wildlife refuges and preserves mainly in Louisiana, but also in Mississippi.
Thanks to hundreds of miles of containment booms, barriers, along with skimmer ships, everything was deployed to help protect estuaries, wetlands, and beaches. If you look at an oil and gas infrastructure map, you'll see a constellation of dense clusters of wells, both onshore and off, in this very resource-rich region. But it also holds incredible ecological treasure, including the Delta National Wildlife Refuge in Louisiana and offshore the Breton National Wildlife Refuge.
the place to keep in mind was the Chandelier Islands is another one. And then when you talk about Breton, that was also, you know, that was the second sanctuary that Teddy Roosevelt set up, and it was the only one he visited. So, you know, the oil spill was, you know, it's not only was it, are these places important for the environment, but, you know, they really are, many of these places date back to the beginnings of the conservation movement and some of our very first places that we put aside to protect.
And the timing of this spill, this specific season, could not have been worse, Pearson said.
It was the height of the breeding season. You know, those birds of the Gulf Coast, they nest colonially. They nest on barrier islands. And then they, you know, they feed on fish in the nearshore waters. So think about that for a minute in terms of the oil spill. When you have brown pelicans and beach nesting terns and gulls in great numbers on very low-lying islands out in the Gulf, feeding in the open water at the height of their breeding season with many more birds coming through.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service naturally chose Audubon as a first responder because of its historic presence in the region.
It's an interesting story because what Fish and Wildlife told us is they have people to go out and get old birds and bring them back. They have the rehabilitation center set up, but what they don't have is anyone to take the birds, the old birds, from the boats to the trucks to take them to the centers. And so actually one of Audubon's first jobs was stationing volunteers at four different docks along the coast and just taking the old birds off the boats into the trucks where they could be rehabilitated. And the other thing that's just remarkable about chapters and volunteers and the Audubon network is we got that request at about 11 p.m. and had volunteers on all the docks at 6 a.m. the next morning.
The Moss Point Beach Cleanup Steward's Oil Bird Transfer Station helped to save many oiled birds, Pearson said.
You know, a lot of areas were oiled. Many marshes, many birds were affected. Actually, as of on September 16th, the Fish and Wildlife Service issued the first numbers that we've seen. And so about 4,600 birds were collected. Of those, about 3,600 were dead. So about 1,000 that were collected were rehabilitated in those four centers and released. So it's certainly it's not as significant as it could have been, but 4,000, you know, almost 5,000 birds is still 5,000 birds, and that's a serious issue.
The highest bird mortality occurred among laughing gulls. Lots of Gulf breeding species were also affected. Brown pelican, American oyster catcher, Wilson's plover, reddish egret, black skimmer, clapper rail, and mottled duck. Then there's the migratory birds, including the common loon, blue-winged teal, American white pelican, northern harrier, and peregrine falcon, some of which summer in parts of Arkansas. And who knows how many more birds died at sea or in obscurity along isolated coastlands. Surviving oiled birds were also taken to rehab centers set up in Hammond, Louisiana, Theodore, Alabama, and Pensacola, Florida. Once stabilized, they were washed several times, fed, and their condition logged. Those that survived were banded and released into habitats not threatened by the oil spill. Now scientists are studying the long-term effect of chemical dispersants sprayed on the ocean surface to dissolve the oil muck.
Our expertise is with birds and not with chemical solvents, you know, thousands of gallons going into, you know, unknown effects. So we really don't know, and we've had to rely on some of our partners on that. The Ocean Conservancy, Oceana, others are looking at that. But when you think about birds, you know, think about the food chain as well. And so those chemicals in the water, we've already talked about the birds that feed in the open water. In addition to the chemicals, what's the lasting effect of the oil that hit the sand and the invertebrates that were killed? You know, what is the effects on this on the food supply?
So the estuaries and seashores are mostly clean of surface oil now, would you say?
I would not say that.
No.
There's still many, many places where you can go and you can reach your hand into the sand and you can squeeze the sand and oil will come out in your hands. There's still oil in many of the marshes. Our probably big mission now is to tell people this is not cleaned up and this is not over.
A recent article published on Audubon Magazine's website said voters in the Gulf Coast states, both Republican and Democrat, overwhelmingly support restoring the health of the region, and they want BP to pay for it. The U.S. government is holding British Petroleum responsible and accountable for all cleanup costs and other damage.
One of the things last week was in the news as well. The Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, has produced a plan for not just response to the oil spill, but restoration of the Gulf. And one of the key recommendations in that plan is that EPA will assess fines to BP. And it will be based on barrels or gallons of oil, and it'll be a big number. But with EPA, those fines will just go into the general treasury, and they can be spent on anything. And so one of the things that in the Mabus plan is that Ray Mabus urges Congress, really the Senate, to make sure that those dollars go back to coastal Louisiana.
And Kevin Pearson says the National Audubon Society is on task for as long as it takes to restore damaged Gulf Coast preserves. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
For links associated with this story, go to ozarksatlarge.com.
It is Wednesday, October 6, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin, the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
So two reporters and Sarah Palin walked into a bar.
We're going to start with a joke, are we? Okay.
No, because I haven't ever written the punchline for it. But journalists spend much time this time of year trying to be funny about the news.
Intentionally funny.
And when you see them doing the two-step in the newsroom and rewriting lyrics to West Side Story, it is a sure sign that the Northwest Arkansas Gridiron Show is headed for the stage again.
This weekend.
This year, it is called Gridiron in 3D, Dizzy, Daffy, and Disorderly. And among the things that they will be poking fun at, the millage people complain about school improvements. Audiences meet the Real Housewives of Hiawassee. You can find out what happens when soccer and the rodeo of the Ozarks get together. A new member joins the Supremes on the nation's highest court, and Lucy tries to sell viewers on the benefits of Votatax Avengerin.
All happens live on stage in front of you.
If you aren't laughing, you should be, and you should go to Gridiron at 7:30 Friday and Saturday. That is a half an hour earlier than in the past. Mm-hmm. Doors open at 6:45 at Rogers Little Theater's Victory Theater in downtown Rogers. Tickets are $25, and they go toward journalism scholarships. Because you still need us. You do, really. And you can find out more at nwagridiron.com. You might also take note. Mm-hmm. There's this MC.
Well, there are two this year.
And that's the new part. They're going to have a tag team set of MCs. And one of them is this guy named Kyle Kellums.
I'm looking forward to this. And I have a wonderful partner.
His wife, Laura.
Yes, who used to be a journalist.
No, you never used to be a journalist.
You always are.
You're always a journalist.
Well, yes, we are very honored to be asked to be the co-hosts.
I'm pretty sure honored is never a word that's been used about that before, but they're going to try to keep the wheels on and the train running down the tracks toward its inevitable crash. Have a good time. Also coming up, Stone's Throw Dinner Theater in Carthage, which a lot of people drive up to, is doing same time next year starting Friday. Love that play. You'll find more about this in What's Up on Friday. But these are just some little notes. The Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center will be playing Friday at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville.
That's part of the 10x10, is it not?
Yes, it is. And it's called Great Quintets. There's festivals all over on Saturday. The Yesterday's Festival in Elm Springs. Puppets in the Park at Wilson Park in Fayetteville. The Pea Ridge Mule Jump.
That's right.
At Pea Ridge High School. Wilson Park Art Walk at Wilson Park in Fayetteville, and Mother Nature will be reading again at Hobbs State Park Conservation Area.
Plenty to do this coming weekend.
Absolutely. You can find it all Friday in What's Up.
Becca, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kyle.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Kevin Cronin, lead singer for REO Speedwagon, was born on this date in 1951. The group formed in the late 60s at college in Champaign, Illinois. The band's name came from Ransom Eli Olds, an early 20th century truck manufacturer of the Speedwagon model, commonly used for fire engines. In 1971, the band signed to Epic Records. The American rock band grew in popularity in the Midwestern United States during the 70s and peaked in the early 1980s as one of America's most popular arena bands at that time. The band's first mid-70s FM hit was Riding the Storm Out, and their first gold record was a live album, 1977's Live, You Get What You Play For. Other REO Speedwagon hits include Keep On Lovin' You and Can't Fight This Feeling. Both songs are power ballads, the former being prototypical of the genre and appearing on the group's most commercially successful album, High Infidelity. That album also included the hit Take It On the Run, a song that peaked at number 5 on the US charts. REO Speedwagon continues to tour regularly, performing mostly their classic hits. They are popular on the fair and casino circuits, but still team with other acts to play larger venues. The Southern Tenant Farmers Museum opened 4 years ago on this date. The museum is owned and operated as an educational program of Arkansas State University in Jonesboro and focuses on the tenant farming system of agriculture in the South and the farm labor movement that arose in response to this system. Also on this date in 1927, the era of talking pictures arrived with the opening of The Jazz Singer, starring Al Jolson. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Friday night, the Grammy-nominated Tierney Sutton Band will perform twice in the Star Theater at Walton Arts Center. The band, fronted by Tierney Sutton, has twice been nominated for the Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Album. Recently, Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, talked with Tierney Sutton about how she's kept the same band together for more than 15 years, the responsibilities of being the front person of a band, and how a jazz ensemble and problem-solving are closely related. Here's a portion of that conversation.
Your Grammy-nominated recording, I'm with the band, which is on Telarc Records, expresses for me a very admirable sentiment for a jazz vocalist to embrace. Can you explain the inspiration for that title?
Well, it was funny because I had wanted to call the record I'm with the band, and while we were taking the promo photos or the cover photos for the record, my manager at the time said, "You're not going to believe the T-shirt that somebody was wearing right outside." And there was this woman wearing a T-shirt that said, "I'm with the band." And I said, "We got to call the record that."
You're kidding me.
Yeah. And it was a live record, and the only concept animating that record was that it would be live performances and the band after the band being on the road. And it was right around the time that the band incorporated, and we really became partners. And you know, my philosophy really early on was that I thought that's what jazz was about. I didn't know that it was anything that unusual. But when I look at my jazz heroes, when I look at Sheila Jordan or Sarah Vaughan or Ella Fitzgerald or any of these people, they attached themselves to instrumentalists and were part of something. You know, the greatness of their singing was partly their voices, but a lot of the greatness of their singing was the way they interacted with other musicians. And to me, being a jazz singer is having that ability to adjust. I've always thought that was just sort of central to what a jazz singer was. And I understand the pressure, you know, of being the front person and feeling like you really want the show to be of a certain quality, but I don't know. The caliber of the players that I'm always working with always just blows me away, and I feel so humbled by them. I wouldn't dream of implying that they weren't doing a good enough job on stage. I mean, I'm trying to keep up with them half the time.
My heart beats so that I can hardly speak. And I seek to find the happiness I seek when
That brings us to the subject of your band, pianist Christian Jacob. You work with two bassists, Trey Henry and Kevin Axe, and drummer Ray Brinker. You've been together since
1992, 1993.
Goodness. That is no small accomplishment in itself. I mean,
no.
The whole evolution of your band and the way you guys do business, I think, is worth discussing a little bit. I've read that you have incorporated some of the ideals of your faith, of the Baha'i principles. Could you talk just a little about that?
Sure. Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I was talking to somebody today about just the idea that, to me, the essential nature of what jazz is in its essence is this music of the moment, where you hopefully prepare your skill level so that you can be ready to interact with people. And you have a common language, but then you take it to a different place. And there's an idea in the Baha'i faith about problem solving in groups that we call consultation. And in consultation, there's certain rules. And these rules are things that I think jazz musicians and other musicians kind of understand without having to be told, because of the way good music functions. And those rules and principles are things like, if you have an idea, you put your idea on the table and then you detach your ego from it. So you don't continually refer to my idea.
You don't own it.
No, you don't own it. You assert it and you try to get your facts. And you try to be heard if you think something's important. But then you back away and then you listen. And you make sure that everyone else is heard as well. And so the idea that the final idea that you come up with by the end of the consultation is going to be more than the sum of its parts. And I think all musicians understand that idea.
Fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime and moon lights up the night. I light up when you call my name and I know you're gonna treat me.
The Tierney Sutton Band will perform twice, Friday night at Star Theater and Walton Arts Center. The first show's at 8, the second at 10. For more information, waltonartscenter.org. She talked with Robert Ginsberg. He's the host of Shades of Jazz, heard every Friday night from 10 until midnight on KUAF 91.3 FM. And to hear more from their conversation and more samples of the band, you can go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Greenland, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years.
Gridiron in 3D, Dizzy, Daffy, and Disorderly, the 2010 Northwest Arkansas Gridiron Show, will be Friday, October 8th and Saturday the 9th at the Rogers Little Theater. Doors open at 6:45 p.m. for general seating. The show begins at 7:30. The show is co-produced by the Northwest Arkansas Society of Professional Journalists and the Fayetteville branch of the American Association of University Women. Tickets are available at nwagridironshow.com.
And full disclosure, Antoinette, you'll be performing in the Gridiron, will you not?
I will, and you will be the MC, will you not?
I will indeed. Friday and Saturday nights at 7:30. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Join me tomorrow at noon for another new edition of Ozarks at Large.